This is The Europeans, your favourite podcast about your favourite continents. Can I say that?
No.
Probably going too far. I can't speak for everyone listening to this. But anyway, this is Katie in Paris, and my usual co-host, Dominic Kramer, has again abandoned me because apparently he has a quote-unquote professional singing career.
Boring.
And he's very busy at the moment, singing in a lot of different productions. So in his place, as you will have heard just now, I'm very happy to be joined this week by our other resident Amsterdammer. It's our producer, Katz Laszlo. Hi, Katz.
Hi. I just realised that all I've said is no and boring. Hello.
Setting the tone for this week. How have you been?
I've been good. I actually wanted to tell the listeners that since I last came on the show and researched cold dipping, I've been going every week.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's not like I'm like a whole new person who is never grumpy, but I'm genuinely feeling way more energetic and like feeling wonder in the winter, which is pretty wild considering it's like late January.
Yeah, I was going to say kudos for committing to that in this weather. I'm assuming it's been as cold in Amsterdam as it has been here.
Yeah, I even got in with ice. I was quite impressed with myself.
Whoa.
Yeah, anyway, so I can recommend. How are you doing, Katie?
I'm okay. I've been having quite a contemplative week, I guess. Mm. It won't have escaped anyone's notice that it has been the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz this week. Mm. And I've been reading Primo Levi's memoir of his time at the death camp, If This Is a Man. And it's an incredibly difficult read, obviously, despite the beauty of his writing. But it feels particularly strange to be reading it at the time when there seems to be a lot of reassessment going on in the far right, especially, about how we should remember things. It's a popular topic for the AfD in Germany, and notably something that the increasingly loathsome Elon Musk tapped into when he made his video appearance at an AfD rally last week. He said there had been too much focus in Germany on guilt and that people shouldn't have to feel guilty about things that their great-grandparents did. And yeah, I don't know. I've been thinking a lot recently about what a tricky, slippery thing memory culture is. I mean, if we don't remember, then we're in danger of forgetting the terrible things that we have done to each other in the past, and therefore in more danger of repeating them. But if remembering things starts to feel like a chore, you know, like eating your vegetables or something you do because you have to, that also feels really dangerous. So, yeah, I don't know. This anniversary is taking place at a very strange time for thinking about these things.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's also just so baffling to think, like, learning about this at school, I just couldn't have imagined the way this conversation has progressed since then.
Yeah.
Oof, what a week. And I don't think the show is going to be a hell of a lot lighter. Katie, what are we talking about this week?
Well, at least we're talking about animals. So that's nice, right?
Yes.
But in a depressing context. We have been talking about humans a lot recently, so we figured it was time to talk about Europe's animals for a change. Butterflies, specifically, and one butterfly in particular, the most endangered butterfly in Europe, the Macedonian grayling.
I can see how this is moving rapidly from jolly to not jolly.
Well, at least it's about butterflies. If this butterfly is so endangered, how is it possible to buy one of these butterflies, recently captured and killed, on the internet for about 30 euros? We have been talking to one of these scientists involved in an investigation into why this is happening, Kirill Alsovsky-Purjo. That is coming up after.
Let's start with you, Katie. Who has had a good week?
I am giving my good week to Belarus's dictator, Alexander Lukashenko.
The joy continues.
He has just been re-elected as president with 87.6% of the vote. Are you surprised?
Oh, congratulations, Lukashenko.
Yes. I hope it goes without saying that this is an ironic good week. We are not particular fans of fraudulent elections here at The Europeans. And the repression of the pro-democracy movement in Belarus is something we have watched with horror in recent years. But nevertheless, Lukashenko has had a very good week. He is about to begin a seventh term as president. He has been in the job for more than 30 years now. And there is no sign currently that anyone can topple him anytime soon.
Mm. Okay, but hang on. He didn't get 100% of the vote. That suggests that someone ran against him?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it's not really funny. It's funny in a dark kind of way, I guess.
Hilarious.
Here's a joke for you. Poland's foreign minister, Radosław Sikorski, tweeted, "Only 87.6%? Will the rest fit inside the prisons?" Which is pretty dark. But yeah, there were, in fact, four other candidates you could vote for. That's democracy. But all of these candidates were loyal to Lukashenko. One of them, the communist candidate Sergei Sirankov, he literally told the BBC, quote, "There is no alternative to Alexander Lukashenko as the leader of our country, so we are taking part in the election with the president's team."
So there were these big pro-democracy protests in Belarus in 2020. I actually learned a lot about this from you because you made a special episode of The Europeans with Belarusian poet Hanna Koma not long after that.
Yeah.
And that episode was about the experience of being jailed for taking part in those protests. Can you give us a reminder of what's happened in the years since then?
Yeah, it's a pretty bleak story, I'm afraid. These big protests that we saw in 2020 after the rigged elections. You'll remember seeing these huge crowds of people waving red and white flags, the old flag of Belarus, in Minsk after these elections that Lukashenko supposedly won, again with about 80% of the vote, even though it was known that millions of people voted for the main opposition candidate, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. You'll probably also remember the images of the brutal police repression that followed those protests. There were mass arrests of opposition activists, and even until very recently, actually, people who wouldn't consider themselves to be activists, simply people who might have, you know, liked an anti-government post on social media, these kinds of people have been facing prison time. Those leaders of the protest movement who didn't manage to flee abroad or who chose not to have disappeared behind bars. And Svetlana Tikhanovskaya herself, she had to go into exile along with so many others. Now, Russia played a very supporting role to Lukashenko's government during the protests and afterwards. You have to remember that this was the biggest crisis that Lukashenko had faced in nearly three decades of being in power, the closest he had ever come to being toppled. So he needed help, and Russia was there to offer it. The Russians helped to stage pro-regime demos. They helped a lot with online and media messaging to make it look like more people were pro-regime than you might think looking at the streets. And Putin also sent Lukashenko a bunch of money, certainly more than $1.5 billion, which was especially helpful when Western countries started sanctioning Belarus for the crackdown on the protests, leaving the Belarusian economy more isolated than ever. And then, of course, we all know how Lukashenko showed his gratitude to Putin for all of this help. February 2022 rolls around, Russia launches its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and how does Putin do it? He does it via Belarus. And these days, some analysts studying the region see Belarus as really barely functioning these days as a properly independent country anymore. Lukashenko used to do that thing of trying to play Russia and the West off against each other to see if he could get something out of it. But it's been a long time since he used that strategy. Belarus now hosts Russian nuclear weapons on its territory. Their economies are super tied together. It's almost like Belarus has become this kind of puppet state that has become absorbed into, yeah, this empire that Putin seems to fantasize about rebuilding.
Oh man, I just looked it up and Lukashenko has been in charge since I was 15 months old. Has the opposition lost hope entirely about things ever changing, or is there some little grain somewhere?
Yeah, I don't think they've lost hope entirely, at least not publicly. Obviously, the reaction to Lukashenko winning Sunday's election has been nothing like what we saw in 2020. It has been extremely muted. Belarusian opposition activists in exile did stage some protests in other countries where they're living now, notably quite a big one in Warsaw. But there were certainly no protests in the streets in Minsk, even though this election was, if anything, more of a sham than the last one. Because after all, a lot of the existing opposition have either been locked up or left the country. Tikhanovskaya literally told people in Belarus not to go out and protest because it's too dangerous. More than 500,000 people have left the country since 2020. Ugh. It is an astonishing number of people. And those who stayed know all too well by now how dangerous it is to speak out. So it does seem very bleak, the prospect for change. At the same time, the opposition in exile, they really stress that whatever these election results say, 88% of the population apparently backing another 5 years of Lukashenko staying in power, whatever those official results are, a lot of the remaining population cannot be happy with the direction that Lukashenko has taken the country in. For historical reasons, you know, a lot of people don't love the idea of being a kind of vassal state to Moscow. And privately, we can assume that a lot of people have at least asked themselves the question of whether their country might be richer right now with more opportunities if Belarus had turned towards the West and not to Russia. So over the past week, we've heard the opposition insisting from abroad that the people aren't with Lukashenko. At the same time, the hope of actually changing anything while Putin is still in power doesn't seem very bright. There doesn't seem to be any practical way of dislodging him from power. So that, unfortunately, is the extent of the hope right now, that there is this base level of hatred for Lukashenko and for what he has done to the country. But until Putin is out of power, there might not be anything that anyone can do about it.
Listening to you talk, I keep having to think about all of my neighbors in Spain who grew up under just like decades of Franco. And I just really wonder what that was like when eventually, inevitably, it ended.
Yeah, and maybe that's one of the shreds of hope to cling to, that it does end.
Hooray!
Pretty miserable for a good week. But I did really want to give people an update on Belarus because it's been a while since we talked about it. So sorry, and you're welcome. Let's move on. Who has had a bad week, Kat?
So I am giving bad week to 78-year-old climate activist in the UK, Gay Delap, who has just heard that her prison sentence has been extended by yet another 20 days for the rather wild reason that they can't find a tag that is small enough for her wrists to let her go back to being under home curfew. The court had actually ruled that she could be at home on this curfew, but then because of the tag fiasco, they charged her with being unlawfully at large on top of her original sentence and brought her back into jail.
What? I mean, the whole thing sounds mad. I have questions about the tag, but
they will be answered.
Good, good to hear. But let's back up for a second. Why was this woman in prison in the first place? What did she actually do wrong, this 78-year-old?
Yeah, I have to admit there is a lot to unpack. I fell down many rabbit holes. But let's start with the beginning. So Gay is a retired school teacher from Bristol. And in her retirement, she started protesting for an organization called Just Stop Oil. Mm-hmm. Climate-motivated civil disobedience is something a lot of pensioners are doing because they know it risks arrest. And in that sense, young people, they argue, have more to lose.
I like this. It kind of reminds me of the Swiss activists who took on the massive climate case against the government.
Yeah, I like it too. Go pensioners. So she was one of the people who climbed over the gantries, which is not a word I knew before.
What's a gantry?
No, I thought maybe I wasn't English enough, but it's not just me. So it is one of those like bridge scaffoldings you see over the highway that's, you know, holds the sign that says London, 25 miles.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So they climbed onto one of those on the M25, which is this huge circular highway that goes around London. And they dropped banners on the car lanes so that the police were forced to stop traffic.
So she climbed up this thing at the age of 78. That's pretty impressive.
I know, it was pretty impressive. And I will say she was 75 at the time, but still very impressive. But anyway, it worked. They managed to block the M25 for 4 days and left an estimated 707,000 drivers in traffic jams. And also, the recent Labour government actually took on their demand, which was to ban new drilling projects for oil and gas in the North Sea. Mm-hmm. So the government listened. When Gay was getting involved in this protest, she knew she'd probably get arrested and might get sentenced in some way. But she and her companions were expecting something like community service, you know, maybe for a long time, but nothing major. So it came as a huge shock when she was instead sentenced to 20 months in prison.
Jesus.
I know, it's pretty wild. There were 5 others with her who got similar, slightly longer charges.
Okay, but hang on. The UK, the proud nation of my birth, it's supposedly a free country where it's legal to protest. What is the crime that she committed, specifically, according to the courts?
So the official charge is causing a public nuisance, which they did. I mean, I don't want to downplay the impact. There was a story of someone missing their father's funeral, a kid with special needs not getting their medication in time. And I mean, there were just hundreds of thousands of people caught in this. The cost of the disruption, both in terms of the police costs and also the costs because of the people who were working, who were trapped in traffic, that all added up to hundreds of thousands of pounds. And obviously that does matter. But also, protest has involved disruption for a long time. Like, that's kind of the point. It's not supposed to be comfortable.
Right.
And these are just unprecedentedly long charges for peaceful protests. Rather wildly, after the defendants tried to say that their motivation was to prevent a climate crisis, which will cause way more damage, both in giving people disabilities. I mean, there are already many people losing their lives. It will cost a huge amount of public and private money. A court order actually banned the defendants in Gaye's trial from mentioning the words climate crisis, fuel poverty, and even the words Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement.
What?
I know, it's pretty wild.
I'm struggling to recognize this as like the court system of a functioning democracy right now. Like, freedom of speech, that's supposed to be a thing in a country like the UK, no?
Yeah, and I mean, there's a whole complicated sidebar I'm not going to get too much into where climate protesters have tried to argue, like, that all damage is justifiable because the damage of the climate crisis is worse. But still, it feels a little extreme that they're not even allowed to talk about it in the court. And as former guest of the show and climate journalist George Monbiot pointed out, this is also really concerning because what that means is the court makes no distinction between someone who's just causing chaos for selfish reasons, like random vandalism, and someone who's protesting, which is remarkable because there are huge differences based on motivation across our justice system. Like, it makes a difference if it's manslaughter or murder. But so these defendants were at least partially censored from talking about their motives. And in fact, UN Special Rapporteur for Climate Defenders, Michelle Forst, came to the UK to investigate these cases against climate activists and said, it is very difficult to understand what could justify denying the jury of the opportunity to hear the reason for the defendant's action and how a jury could reach a properly informed decision without hearing it.
Right. I mean, let's face it, the details of this specific case seem absolutely balmy. But one thing I do feel like I've been vaguely aware of recently is, hasn't the UK been developing a reputation for being particularly harsh when it comes to handing down these really pretty serious sentences to climate activists?
Yeah, exactly. It was on my radar too, but I had no idea, honestly, until I properly researched it for this show, to what extent this was happening. Shortly before Gaye's trial, four other people who were on the Zoom call that planned the blockade of the M25 were charged with 4 years in prison each.
For being on the Zoom call to plan it.
Yeah, and wildly, one of them was only on the Zoom call. They weren't even at the roadblock.
Wow.
And that person's charge was just conspiracy to plan public nuisance, which is pretty scary because that could be applied to a lot of people. There's no record of such long prison sentences for peaceful protests or even planning a protest, as far as we know, in UK history. And I mean, yes, they cause a nuisance, but if you think of how many of our rights have been fought for by disruptive protests, I mean, you and me wouldn't have even been able to go to school or vote without, you know, the suffragette movement. So yeah. It's a pretty fundamental part of how we've gotten to our democracy today.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, the demands that Gaye and her fellow protesters were arguing for were actually taken on by the government. But that doesn't mean their extensive punishments were dropped. To add to the punishments, on the morning of the protest, the court ordered an injunction, which the protesters didn't know about, which meant that anyone participating would be made to pay £200,000 in legal fees. Now, this is not normal. So protesters like Gaye may have known they were risking arrest, but like multiple years in jail and these huge sums of money, they just had no idea that this is what they were risking.
So where exactly has this trend of treating climate activists so harshly in the UK justice system, like, where has that come from?
So in the past few years, the previous Conservative government in the UK came up with a bunch of new laws that makes it possible to charge protesters way more easily. People call these the new public nuisance laws. One of them, the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Act in 2022, makes it possible to give people a 10-year sentence. And the other one, the Public Order Act of 2023, makes it possible to criminalise even peaceful demonstrations. Mm. These laws were also used to jail a peaceful protester, for example, for walking slowly down a road for 30 minutes. And as I said, Michelle Force, the UN Special Rapporteur, he has been investigating this, and he said it's important to highlight that prior to these legislative developments, it has been almost unheard of since the 1930s for members of the public to be imprisoned at all for peaceful protests in the UK, let alone for this long. He also added that he is seriously concerned about these regressive new laws. And actually, not long after those laws were first announced, the UK branch of Extinction Rebellion announced that they were going to be moving away from protest and public disobedience. Mm. They said they wanted to stay accessible and were worried they couldn't safely encourage people to protest if this was the judicial climate they were operating under.
It's starting to sound a little bit like Belarus here.
I know, it's really not the image that I had. It's really much more extreme than I realised. But other groups like Just Stop Oil that Gay was a part of, they ramped up their actions instead.
And so this Labour government, which after all ended up doing what Gay and her fellow protesters wanted, has it responded to all of this?
Yeah, so I find it a bit difficult to see exactly how they're responding. I mean, they're now in power, and that doesn't mean that these laws written before they were in charge are not being applied anymore. Their initial attitude seems to be that they sort of wanted to let the court continue to decide how it applies laws and said that the government shouldn't get involved. Just last week, a Ministry of Justice spokesperson said, "We are bound by law to enforce sentences passed down by the independent judiciary, and this includes handing down additional days in custody when the law dictates." But yeah, obviously, pressure has been mounting that the Labour government should scrap these recent public nuisance laws because of wild cases like Gay's. And I can imagine that's only going to continue.
Also, isn't all of this happening, this jailing of climate activists, at a time when the UK's prisons are super overcrowded, no?
Yeah, so that is one of the most infuriating things about this very infuriating case. At the same time as this was going on, 1,700 prisoners were let out early because there just wasn't enough space for them. And I mean, I can't tell you about the details of any of those cases, and nor do I want to pass a value judgment on any of their cases. But I can say that many of those people had committed more violent crimes than Gay had.
So there is a pretty decent case for her to be let free then.
Yeah, and many have argued that she is an excellent candidate for early release. I mean, she's not really a danger to society. She's 78 at this point.
There are dangerous 78-year-olds in the world.
Oh no, that's so true. And she was actually released from prison last November, given this home curfew, where she had to be at home between 7 in the morning and 10 p.m. But then a problem came up. She can't have a home arrest tag fitted to her ankle because she has a history of deep vein thrombosis. And it seems that the justice system cannot find a tag that fits her wrist.
Because she's too old and thin. Is that the problem?
Exactly.
God.
Something else I noticed was that Gay's jail time, when she goes back into prison, costs the government £50,000 per year.
£50,000. You would think that for £50,000, they could make like a beautiful, bespoke, like Swarovski crystal prison tag.
Oh my God, diamond encrusted. It is
for this one woman. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely valid question. I mean, I just cannot believe that like Silicon Valley tech bros are talking about us going to live on Mars to survive climate change, but we can't make this woman a tag. I just cannot understand.
Astonishing.
And I mean, I would argue that everyone, regardless of their wrist size, should be subject to the same justice system. But since we are on the subject, it's not like she has a crazy small wrist. It's apparently 14 and a half centimeters. So I measured my own wrist and mine is 14 centimeters.
Oh my God, Katz, you better not go committing any crimes. Or
I know, that's what I thought. But I mean, seriously, it is quite serious. can the tagging company really not build a tag that basically fits a woman?
Yeah, yet another example of the world not being designed for women's bodies.
Something I also can't really make sense of is that it seemed like Gay was initially allowed to be at home curfew in spite of the lack of tag. Like, at that point, they had a probation officer who would come round and check if she was at home on time.
That seems like a good solution.
Yeah, but then at some point, for reasons that are not clear to me, they changed their mind and said that because she had no tag, she might have to go back to prison. Gay's not allowed to talk to the press while she's under home arrest, but while she was waiting to hear the decision, her brother said, "This is very cruel. Gay is sitting at home, terrified with her suitcase packed, waiting for a knock on the door from police. She's been unable to eat or sleep because of this. She is hoping against hope that sense can prevail and that she won't have to go back to jail." He also said that Gay has various health problems and continues to have no feeling in one finger after being handcuffed for a hospital visit during her time in prison. Oh my God, I just cannot, this whole story. But unbelievably, as we now know, of course, after that stressful visit, Gay was called back into jail 4 days before Christmas with a new charge of being unlawfully at large, which is essentially because the justice system doesn't have enough tags in her size. I mean, why is she being punished with a new sentence for what is essentially a failure of the justice system, not hers? Just a couple of days ago, the Ministry of Justice and Serco, the company that manages the tagging system, said they were looking into the issue. Another horrifying thing is that Serco has been fined on two occasions with fraud, one £23 million fine for fraudulent contracts in 2019, and another £70 million settlement in 2013 for charging for tagging people who were dead in jail or who had left the country.
Oh, wow. So they're not even necessarily that good at running this whole tagging business.
Clearly not. This is not the first mistake.
And you would think after all of this, this kind of case, this crackdown that we're seeing on climate protesters is having a serious effect on how free people are feeling to go out and protest in the UK.
Yeah, the last thing I want to talk about is it's not like there's no fallout from these protests. As I mentioned before, there were serious consequences for some of the people trapped in those traffic jams. And I can completely understand that it feels unfair, infuriating even, to have to face these losses because climate protesters happen to block a road on a day that was really important to you or your business. But if you think about what other crimes get people these kinds of sentences, it's like violent crime, sexual assault, rape cases often get shorter sentences than this. The point of jailing people is supposed to be when they cause a threat to society and themselves. And I think most people would argue that those kind of violent crimes are way more of a threat than a 78-year-old woman who, yes, blocked a road in a pretty dramatic way, but also has no track record of violence and can't get a tag because she has deep vein thrombosis and small wrists. It is just wild. If we zoom out for a minute, this is really concerning for the state of our democracies because now it's climate protests, but also these laws could easily be applied to all kinds of people acting out of their supposedly fundamental right to protest.
Yep.
And well, the defendants might not be able to mention climate crisis or Martin Luther King in court, but we can here. And what they're protesting for is a really urgent and deadly climate crisis. There are already many people dying in floods and fires in this continent alone, let alone further ashore. And yet people running oil companies and also people in the governments that are failing us by not meeting their legally binding targets, we can't even imagine those people facing jail time. And I just cannot imagine how we can explain this to worried citizens now who are already facing the dangers and high costs of the climate crisis, let alone to our grandchildren. Well, I should actually say your grandchildren, because my current plan is to spend the rest of my days as a child-free millennial that just brings out the naughty side in Baby Lee.
I like that you've assigned yourself this job for life.
I approve. Yes, very important function in society. But can you imagine telling those kids, like, oh yeah, we used to give climate protesters longer sentences than people who've been committed violent crimes? I certainly cannot.
Well, something that will definitely lift the mood after that, especially miserable good week, bad week from us, is drawing your attention to the heartwarming generosity of our listeners in keeping the Europeans in business as a tiny independent podcast. We exist because you like the show enough to pay for it, frankly. So a massive thank you goes out to the latest people to send some money our way via the website Patreon. Who are they, Kat?
Thank you so much to Santiago, Morag and Barbara for your very generous donations.
I'm feeling extra grateful at the moment because we recently managed to wrap up our crowdfunding campaign for our new series, which means we can make some great new investigative episodes later this year. And we can also stop annoying everyone by talking about it every week. But the reason I mention it is because we made a little video for Instagram to celebrate raising 100% of our crowdfunding. And you said something very nice and very true in this video, Kats. You said, journalism has felt hard and heavy for the past few years, and you can easily feel like people are not kind and generous. And this is the opposite. You are kind and generous. So thank you very much. It feels really good. And yeah, you know, international politics, as discussed, has been pretty depressing recently. And I'm really conscious that in these dark times, we are so lucky to have an amazing, positive, thoughtful listenership for this podcast that is willing to contribute financially to keep this small, independent, but very special podcast in existence. So a massive thank you to everyone who supports us. If you like what we do, you can also do something amazing by supporting us. All amounts, big and small, are extremely welcome. And you can find all the info at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. The link is in the show notes. So, Kats, I tend to think of you as the resident nature person on our team. Like, all of us like nature, I should clarify, but you're kind of our chief nature person.
Yeah, I do. I do feel things. Biodiversity is also one of my favourite subjects, which is relevant to this week's interview segment, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And how do you feel about bugs, insects in particular?
I feel very worried about bugs. I remember reading back in, like, I think it was 2017, a 27-year-long study told me that the flying insect population in Germany had fallen by 76%.
Yikes.
Oh, it's so huge. I mean, I know bugs aren't the most sexy, but that is just wild. And it's not good for us as humans either.
It's not.
I've heard at this point that some farmers are actually ordering bugs in the mail to pollinate their crops.
Wow.
So yeah, I would say concern and gratitude is my feeling for bugs.
Well, this week, I want to bring your attention to one particularly endangered insect. Europe's most endangered butterfly, the Macedonian grayling. It is crazily rare. It lives on the outskirts of a single town in North Macedonia. And yet you can still buy one of these butterflies as a collector very easily on the internet for about 30 euros. Why is this happening? Can it be stopped? Back in October, a team of international journalists and scientists published a really interesting investigation into all of this. And before he went off to his singing rehearsal, Dominic and I spoke to one member of this team, Kirill Alsovsky-Porjo. He is a biologist and science communicator at the Institute of Communication Studies in Skopje, the capital of North Macedonia. And Dominic and I gave Kirill a ring to find out more. Kirill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Why is your country such a hotspot for butterflies and the biodiversity of butterflies?
Macedonia is due to its geography, climatic circumstances, and evolution of the landscape in the last few million years has become a biodiversity hotspot, where many of the species have developed and specialized in different subgenuses and then different species and subspecies, especially when it comes to insects and butterflies. And this can have two reasons. One of them is the flora or the biodiversity of plants, because plants and butterflies are closely connected. They're part of the life cycle. Our map, geographically, it's covered by so-called IBAs, important butterfly areas. So these are geographical areas which are with high significance on international level for reproduction of butterflies or just places or areas where they live. So this makes Macedonia, although it's very small by territory, one of the smallest countries in Europe, very important biodiversity-wise.
So you've been working on an investigation about Europe's most endangered butterfly, the Macedonian grayling. Can you start by describing this butterfly to us? What does it look like and how does it behave?
It's a small grayish butterfly, not very charismatic. It's not very attractive to see it. Many people will miss it in the field. It has very cryptic life cycle. We don't know much about this butterfly and their ecology. And the most important thing about it is this butterfly can be found only on very, very small areas, few kilometer squares at maximum, but in reality, just a few hundred meters. The Macedonian grayling home is located in a high grassland hilltops in the center of Macedonia, close to the city of Prilep, which is very old, ancient city, important for the medieval time of Europe. And all around these white stones and boulders covered with yellow grass, you can find this small, very lazy butterfly.
I find it entertaining that it's a lazy butterfly.
Yes, it's called lazy flyer, which means it's very easily to be captured and caught. It's active only a few hours in the morning when it's not too hot. Their period of activity is just July, so they're active just for a few weeks. And it's in those 3 weeks, they have to find their mate, to copulate, to lay eggs, and they just disappear. So they're very, very cryptic, very shy.
Laziness, though, that presumably is a part of why they are easily caught and easily poached.
Yes, well, the topic of our research was the destiny of this butterfly while being faced by illegal poaching. So this butterfly, because of its rarity, is a part of the national list of endangered and protected species. And this makes it very attractive to collectors. As you know, some people throughout the world have this hobby of taxidermy, of so-called insect taxidermy, where they're collecting rare species, mostly butterflies, maybe sometimes beetles. And because of the rarity of the insect, but also its ecology, being very lazy, very slow flyer, people in the past have been poaching it illegally and selling it for not more than 25 to 30 euros on the open market.
But it is illegal to poach these butterflies. So why is it that they're still available on the market?
In Macedonia, it's illegal to collect it and even to touch it, not little less to kill it, with the exception of doing scientific research, which is done through very rigorous and strict regulations by the government. And our research has led that people are coming in Macedonia as tourists, catching it, collecting it, taking it out of the country and putting it up on sale. Our research has taken to two places where this butterfly is usually sold. Number one is the so-called entomological exchanges. This is like an open expo, open fair, where people are presenting their catch in person. It's not illegal, it's very common. And one of the largest ones are in Europe, for example, Prague, Munich, Frankfurt. These are very popular fairs where people are coming to exchange insects, but also other exotic animals like lizards, like tarantulas and so forth. And the other way, which is more easily done, is through online shops. So eBay shops or a specific website that are having their own business in selling taxidermy, they're selling this. And the thing is that although it's illegal to catch the butterfly in Macedonia, after it leaves the national borders, it's become a gray area. There's no regulation. So technically, it's not illegal, but it's not forbidden. We have seen that these butterflies are extracted from Macedonia and be sold illegally on Western European markets. We don't know who is the final customer is, but we know that the sellers are Polish, Czech, and German companies. And again, these people are aware of the status of the butterfly, but I will suggest that they're misusing the system.
And can we be sure that these butterflies were caught after it became illegal to poach them, I think about a decade ago? Or is it possible that these are, you know, antique specimens that were caught when it was still legal?
Yes, excellent question. So because we knew that some of these insects can be so-called antiquities, but we did a DNA and also carbon dating analysis, which we proved that the butterflies that we found them online and bought them out and tested, these are insects, all of the insects are caught after the national ban of collecting.
Do we know to what extent the Macedonian grayling is endangered because of poaching?
It's very hard to make a specific determination of the influence because we don't know how many of them are coming to our country. But if you ask for the researchers and the scientists who have published paper about the grayling, they will say that although it's a dangerous habit, it's not the only one, it's not the biggest one. And they're transferring the discussion to the queries which are opening up around the area where the butterfly is living, which are directly threatening the existence of the butterfly because there's a possibility of the habitat being quarried out, so completely destroyed.
Quarries is in places where people take rock for use in building, you mean?
Yes. Uh-huh. The Prilep region is historically worldwide known for its marble, high-quality gray marble, so-called Macedonian civets, which means the gray one. And this is very expensive marble that has a white color, but it has a great shade when the sun is shining upon it. So it gives this like silver-looking phenomenon of the appearance.
It was used to build the White House, I think, right?
Yes. The Prilep marble has been used to build most of the Washington, D.C. buildings, the White House. And also it was used in the antiques. For example, the arena in Rome was built by this marble and other imperial palaces were built by this marble just because of the shine. And now many people in the region consider it to be a national treasure. And the new plans for opening new quarries and new mines is directly endangering the butterfly itself. Not just this specific species, but also the whole habitat. And just to point out that dry grasslands are one of the Europe's most endangered habitats, just because of climate change, just because of anthropological influence. So we're not talking just about one butterfly, one very rare but lazy butterfly. We're talking about the whole ecosystem.
I mean, I think we can agree that every time a species goes extinct, it feels like a huge moral failure on the part of humans not to protect the planet. But why does it matter if this specific species disappears beyond it just being a moral failure?
For me, it's as a human, as a species, I think we'll be over our heads if we think that we have the whole knowledge about how the environment works. In the ecosystems, we're talking about millions of ecological networks that we're not aware of them. We don't know how it's connected, how it will be influenced. But there's a thing which is called the ecological cascade, which means that the possibility of one species disappearing will create a whole cascade effect of other animals and plants disappearing. We didn't have invested the amount of resources, time, and effort to do a research about these ecosystems. So we can be absolutely sure how this disappearing of one animal can influence. The fact that we don't know anything about it is supposed to be a factor of importance, not the factor of negligence.
Has there been any change or an attempt to fix this legal loophole that is allowing these butterflies to be sold online since your investigation was published?
The short-term plans for us as a team and also for the Macedonian government is to put this butterfly, this species of butterfly, on so-called CITES list. So CITES is a list of animals and plants which are regulated or forbidden for international transport and market. And by putting this butterfly on the annex of the CITES convention, it will give the fighting chance, so it will become illegal also to be sold outside of the national borders. So this will be the step one. This application is in preparation. The meeting will be held in October, and this will be the place where our team needs to present the case with arguments. From the moment that the butterfly will become a CITES species, everything regarding them, this butterfly internationally, will become illegal following the national laws. So that's the short-term plan. But the long-term plan is just to show how fragile nature can be, and also to show that it's very hard for the governmental agency to look upon every little detail about nature. And Macedonia is a small country, but from European Union's point of view, they can see that the European Union is as a regional leader of democracy, of governance. It still has a lot to do to protect something which is outside of the borders, but being misused by its members.
Yeah, it's interesting you're talking about borders, because we're often struck making this podcast by how borders affect the lives of European humans, like depending on which side of a border you live on and whether it's a side that's in the EU or outside of the EU. But nature obviously doesn't recognize borders. And how do you grapple with that? How do the borders we've made in Europe affect our ability to protect biodiversity?
In my personal theory is that there's no point of seeing the nature on a national border level, even a European border level. Unfortunately, the borders that we live now, the physical, social, political borders in the Balkan Peninsula, are not going in favor of nature, because every decision has to be shared among other countries. Usually those countries are in unfriendly relationships. I cannot imagine how many species and ecosystem has been neglected or destroyed throughout the time just because of this, especially in the case of the Balkan Peninsula. So in my perspective, only a regional approach and collaboration can yield any form of fruitful results for nature conservation.
Something that becomes really obvious when talking to Kirill is just how much harder it is to campaign to save an animal when it's not especially cute. Like, he describes the Macedonian grayling as uncharismatic. And, like, let's be fair, like, these are pretty unremarkable looking butterflies. So it's hard to feel an emotional connection with them in the way that you might with, like, a really colorful, fabulous looking butterfly. And it's definitely way harder than convincing yourself to care about, I don't know, a panda or a polar bear. But boring looking animals are just as important for the ecosystem as the pretty ones.
Absolutely. I actually have a way to get into the emotions on the insect front. I have this weird fascination for acoustic ecology.
What is that?
Yeah, apparently sound is one of the best ways to measure biodiversity because you can just record and compare like the noise year to year.
Interesting.
Yeah, there are some really beautiful interviews with audio ecologists who have been listening to the world for literally decades and hearing it get quieter over their career. Quieter in terms of insects and birds, and sadly, much, much louder in terms of human sounds like engines. I also learned from them just how listening completely and immediately changes the way you move through the world. It's really quite amazing. So now I regularly go out into parks and just listen to see how many creatures I can hear. Huh. I will include some links in the show notes and get you all feeling things about bugs.
Well, that sounds great. I'm looking forward to feeling those feelings. And if you're interested in hearing more about the Macedonian grayling in particular, you should definitely check out the investigation that Kirill worked on. It was produced with funding from journalismfund.eu, who have also funded some of our work in the past. The investigation is in the form of a great 25-minute documentary called Nature for Sale, which is available on YouTube, as well as a written piece. So you'll find links to those too in the show notes. Apart from acoustic ecology, what have you been enjoying this week, Kat?
Oh, I saw something so good. I'm going to go with a bit of a stretch and recommend Haitian-born, sometimes in France and Berlin, living Raoul Peck.
We'll accept it.
He has directed many films, including I Am Not Your Negro, the documentary about James Baldwin. But he now has a new film about Ernest Cole, a South African photographer who famously made an incredible book showing what life under apartheid was. It was quickly banned in South Africa, and Ernest then lived in exile in the States for the rest of his life, dying in poverty after years being homeless, in spite of the fact that he was a pretty famous and well-renowned photographer.
Wow.
The film is just absolutely excellent. I learned and felt so many things about apartheid, about exile, and I think it's just pretty wild looking back at how little I've been like formally taught about apartheid, given I'm half Dutch, half English, the two countries that colonized South Africa. The story the film tells is filled with such humanity and dignity. There were also some clips from the Truth and Reconciliation trials that came in 1996 once apartheid fell. And they are just so powerful and confronting about the very recent legacy of the countries that I call home, and how they impact South Africa still now. Another reason why I'm sneaking it in is because there's a really weird role held by the Swedish bank SEB, and I just loved the way the film dealt with that part of the story, but you will have to watch to find out.
Intriguing. What's it called again?
It was called Ernest Cole, Lost and Found. It's in cinemas here, so I imagine it's in cinemas elsewhere. I learned so much and I was so absorbed. Go and watch it immediately.
Sounds great.
How about you, Katie?
I've got a borrowed recommendation from a listener for you this week. Anna recommends the German Netflix comedy Acht Sam Morden. I think the English title is Murder Mindfully. And it is a series about the lawyer of an organized crime boss. This lawyer isn't very happy with his life. He doesn't get to spend much time with his family because he's so busy working in organized crime. And so his wife suggests that he gets into mindfulness to fix his problems. Mm. Anna says it features very gallows humor and is a great satire on mindfulness. She adds, and I stress that she says this as someone who is German, quote, "We didn't notice that it was a German production because it doesn't have that dreaded German movie feeling. Fellow Germans will understand," she says.
I'll be the judge of that, Anna.
Anna, I don't know what you might mean by that. But she highly recommends checking out this film. You'll find a trailer in the show notes. And actually, I was just reading the comments underneath. People seem to have loved this series too. One person says it is the most well-paced Netflix show that they've ever watched.
Very intriguing. I have actually read that there are some studies that people apologize less if they meditate because they're so comfortable with their own flaws.
There you go. Seems like the perfect match for working in organized crime. So, Cats, this final segment of the show, Happy Ending, is normally Dominic's responsibility, and you're standing in for him this week. What have you got for me?
Yes, I have a happy ending for the world's loneliest bat.
Okay.
So this is another UK story. Sorry, people. But it was actually thought that the greater mouse-eared bat was extinct in the UK. And then in 2002, a single male bat was found in a disused train tunnel. He spent 2 decades as the only bat of this kind in the UK. He spends most of his winters hibernating in the very same train tunnel. He sometimes disappears and then he returns, so he keeps us all on our toes. And then just recently, there have been not one, but 2 young female bats found in different locations in the UK.
Hello, I can see where this is going.
Exactly. They have been carefully tagged, and the hope is that he may fly back to the area and, who knows, maybe make more bats.
This is great news for biodiversity and great news for, like, tagging properly. The whole show has come together.
Oh, it really has. Now, you know, maybe there'll be babies, but at the very least, they'll have a buddy. I mean, imagine being the only one of your species. I have to admit that I had some resistance around the framing of this story because, like, 5 years ago, I remember seeing a study that pandas, who are famously, when they are in captivity, not interested in mating and mocked to no end for it on the internet. It turns out that at least a part of it is that they're just picky about who they want to be intimate with.
Which is fair enough, you know?
Absolutely. Researchers were baffled for a while about why pandas in the wild just seem to find love or find lovers. A little bit of anthropomorphism going on there. But pandas in captivity don't seem to be interested. But it seems that it is the fault of human meddling because they just put pandas together based on genetic diversity. And that just doesn't seem to do it for the pandas. Pandas don't just like any other panda. And, like, I related so much to this as someone who is picky. Famously, they even developed panda porn for these poor pandas to be in captivity. Can you imagine you are minding your own business, trapped in a zoo, and then a bunch of humans keep inviting other pandas into your space and being like, oh, I'll show you some panda porn if you don't have sex with each other. Like, leave the pandas alone.
Yeah, which is porn made by people that don't even understand what I find sexy anyway. So how's that going to work? I mean,
we have no idea what pandas' preferences are. But anyway, who knows what these bats will actually feel for each other. But maybe bats are less picky.
But hang on. So there are these 2, like, lady bats who've turned up. Do we know where their parents are? Like, does this mean that there might actually be more than just the 3 of them?
Yeah, that's what I thought. According to the bat conservation people, they just don't know if there's, like, a secret group of bats that they haven't managed to track down, or if it's just bats coming from mainland Europe as climate change warms things up. It does seem more broadly that climate change is actually good for these bats because, unlike other bats that, like, scoop insects in the sky, these ones actually land on bigger insects like grasshoppers, and then they like roll around on top of them. And it turns out that one of their favorite places to do this is a grape vineyard. And there are more and more grape vineyards in the UK with climate change.
English sparkling wine is becoming a thing.
Exactly. Good news for the bats. there are a lot of questions about why these greater mouse-eared bats are reappearing, and whether or not they will reappear on a grander scale, we do not know. But as the good people of the Bat Conservation Trust wrote, only time and more monitoring will tell. But for now, if it's not for romance, this old bat may have two strapping young bat friends. Yay!
I really thought you were talking about yourself when you said this old bat.
Well, some joy at the end of this show.
Yay! Thank you so much for joining me this week.
Anytime. Nice to speak to you again, Katie.
Lovely to speak to you too. We are actually away next week, taking a little break to start work in earnest on our new series, among other things. We're very, very excited about it. But in the meantime, we are around on the remaining shreds of social media left in the world, Blue Sky, Mastodon, and Instagram for now. Come and hang out with us there. We also love a good old-fashioned email, so you can drop us a line at hello@europeanspodcast.com.
Big thank you to our lovely producers, Wojciech Oleksiak and Morgan Childs, for taking care of the show this week.
We'll be back the week after next. See you then.
Bye.
Do papa dzienia.